My next guest is David H. Johnson, the director of the Global Owl Project. He is currently based in Virginia, but will be returning to the Olympia, Washington area. A former farm boy from Minnesota, David has degrees in civil engineering, natural resource technology, a bachelor's in biology with a minor in archaeology, and a master's in wildlife science. His career has been in wildlife, forestry, fisheries, and engineering. For 46 years, he's been passionate about owls, as you're about to find out. After David's interview, we'll hear from Janice Reed, president of Umpqua Watersheds and retired wildlife biologist, who will share a bit about what's going on with local owl species. Ryan, and I am the host of Living Downstream. Before we begin, I'd like to do a land acknowledgement. I think it's important to remember that the land upon which Umpqua Watershed is located was formerly occupied by various indigenous groups. To start out, can you give an overview of the work that you're doing with the Global Owl Project?
We started the Global Owl Project in 2005. The U.S. National Science Foundation put out a request for proposals under their biodiversity inventory program. And the idea was that if we discovered life on a new planet, we would want to inventory it. We haven't done such a hot job of it here. So they wanted planetary scale inventories of any particular taxa. Okay. Well, we are still finding new owls to science, you know, one or two new per year. And so I said, all right, let's get organized. And so we submitted a proposal, myself and 13 or 14 other folks from around the world, submitted a proposal, and that's how the Global Owl Project got started. And now we have about 450 people working on it in 66 countries. And so there are seven main tasks that we've always been working on. First one is on survey and monitoring techniques. How do you find owls? How do you monitor them? Second task is on genetics. We want to get samples, blood samples and genetic samples from all the owls of the world. The third one is on vocalizations. Owls don't learn their calls. They're genetically inherited. And so getting recordings of vocalizations is very important for species identification. Okay. The fourth task is on morphology and the physical descriptions of owls that are reported to science. This includes all of the current living owls, the extinct owls, and the fossil owls. Okay. The fifth task is on maps. We want to make maps for conservation so that we can actually manage better the landscapes for owls. Yeah? The sixth task is on owls and myth and culture. The idea there is that what people believe about owls makes a difference in how they conserve and protect owls. Well, what in fact do they believe about owls? Let's find out. So that's task six. And task seven is about giving away the publications and the products. This isn't about us. This is about long-term conservation of the owls and the planet. And so we're trying to do this as open and free as we can with everything.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. It brought up a couple of questions in my mind. You mentioned there was a call for doing kind of a global assessment or inventory. So are there global, like other species projects too going on? Do you know?
Sure. Yes, there are. There was one large catfish project that was funded. They were also trying to find a virus or other kind of global ocean related materials. And so there are quite a number of global scale projects that were funded with that program. Yes.
Wow. That's exciting. So what's being done locally, like either in Oregon or in the Pacific Northwest relating to owls?
Certainly, there has been much work done with the spotted owl, the northern spotted owl in the old growth forests and those issues stemming back into the 1970s. Huh? So that's been a major driver of the science and the conservation, and also the major driver of a lot of other owl species around the world. As the spotted owl is an old forest associate species, there are actually more than 85 other species of owls that are also old forest associates. And so as goes the spotted owl issue with the logging and fires and so forth, so does all the other old forest owls. It's a similar issue, different parts of the world. So we've learned very, very much about the ecology and management of the spotted owls. Well, there are many other owls too, yeah? And so there are grassland owls like the burrowing owls in Oregon and Washington that I've been working on for 12 years with other teams and people. In around the Americas, the burrowing owls, but there's pygmy owls, there's western screech owls, there's the invasive barred owls in the Northwest, which are a major problem for the spotted owls, the great horned owls, long-eared owls, short-eared owls, snowy owls, barn owls. Yes, there's quite a few.
Yeah, can you talk a little more about your burrowing owl project? I've been hearing from other people too a little bit about it, and I think that'd be really neat to share with our listeners.
Sure. The project started in 2007 when I was called in by Don Gillis. He was the former and late manager of the Umatilla Army Depot. He just passed away here this past April, but nice man. He called me in with Mike Gregg to ask, he said, we're losing our burrowing owls. This is from North Central Oregon near Hermiston. Okay. He says, we're losing our burrowing owls. David, can you help us do something? We don't know what to do. And so we surveyed around the 17,000 acre area there and found that there really wasn't any burrows. There weren't any holes. It turned out what had happened after we looked back a bit. In 1959, folks brought in pronghorn antelope to the depot. They were fenced in. The numbers increased and then started to crash. And the thought behind the crash was, oh, the coyotes are getting the fawns. Well, it wasn't quite true. It was some change in habitat, more cheatgrass, and some intensive inbreeding, you know, of the pronghorns. But so they had a big trapping program for coyotes. They caught a bunch of coyotes, but in the process caught all of the badgers. And so they zeroed out the badgers. No badger, no holes, no holes, no places for the burrowing owls to nest. So when we got there, the burrowing owls had crashed. Okay. And they had gone from, I don't know, 40, 50 pairs and more to 3 or 4 pairs. We put in artificial burrows as an emergency rescue mission. Okay. Well, the first year we had 9 pairs of owls. We put in a few more burrows, 21 pairs of owls, and then 45. And this past year now we had 62 pairs of owls. And they're all nesting in artificial burrows. So while we can be successful, certainly, in bringing back burrowing owls, something with artificial burrows, that's not a long-term management program. It's a recovery strategy. Huh? So, but we've learned a lot in the last 12 years of this project. We've captured and banded essentially all of the adults and all of the youngsters every year, something like 2,500 individual owls now. And they certainly would have winked out. We would have lost them by 2010 had we not put in artificial burrows. So it's quite a remarkable success story in conservation. And we've learned a tremendous amount about the burrowing owls as a result of that project. So, yes. Now, this particular past year was the best on record, 62 pairs, like I mentioned, and they had 358 youngsters, which is really phenomenal for burrowing owls. Yeah, the best we had.
Yeah, I was wondering, how are you able to catch all of the owls, especially the males, because they don't spend a lot of time in the nest or the burrows, right?
That's correct. At the nesting grounds, the females spend much of their time inside the burrows. Of course, they're laying eggs and then incubating and then brooding the youngsters. So we can put on a trap, a walk-in trap. It's just a metal cage, 6 by 6 by 18 inches. It has swing doors on the end and they only swing in. Okay. So you put that trap on the end and the female, if she's outside, she's motivated to go inside. If she's inside, she'll come out to get some food or defecate and she gets caught. Okay. Not so difficult. The males though, their main job is food delivery and to be the nest guard. So They typically are just, they bring in some food to the doorstep, drop it off, pizza delivery, and off they go hunting again. So they don't usually go in the burrow much. So in order to play on their, what motivates them, okay, the burrow means everything to them. Without that burrow, they're nothing in that territory. So they will defend it rigorously against other males. So I play the call, a little MP3 player in a little speaker, and I use a soft playback of a recorded male that I have of us. It's a single 2-year-old underweight male, a punk. And I play that call, cuckoo, cuckoo, so he can only hear it from 10 to 12 feet. I just want to be a pesky intruder, not a dominant competitor. And when these other existing males hear that, they're not having it. You know, they're not having this guy in there. And he said, they strut back and forth. They puff up like turkeys. They go back and forth. Come out, don't make me come in there. Since the guy doesn't come out, they have to go in. I catch them all.
Yeah, that's neat how you use, like, I don't know, yeah, what they would naturally do against them, sort of, but like to benefit the science and to help you understand the species better. Yeah, I was wondering, so are burrowing owls found elsewhere in the world as well? Like, are there other species or other variations of the burrowing owl besides in Oregon or the Pacific Northwest?
Yes, there are 22 recognized subspecies of the burrowing owl, 2 of which are extinct. Okay, the other 20 are still living, and they're only found in the Americas, North and South America, and some in Central America, the burrowing owls. Okay, and I have a project that we're working on now to investigate 22, really? 22 subspecies, is that it? Are they all the same species? And I think not. And so along with the segment, you should have some audio files that we can play for the folks here. There'll be a call from Oregon. Another one from Ecuador. Another one from Brazil. And should be also one from Aruba. And so the intention is to give folks a chance to hear these other calls, because like I mentioned earlier, owls don't learn their vocalizations. They're genetically inherited. So if they sound different, they likely are different species. Okay, but let's find out. So we're getting morphological data, measurement, body measurements. We're getting genetic data from these owls. We're getting vocalizations from the males. Okay. And we're getting distribution. These 4 things help to characterize, are they really full species or are they subspecies? And so let's let the science tell us. Yes, it's quite an interesting project.
I understand you've been doing some additional work on vocalizations recently. So can you tell more about that project?
Yes. So if the owl's vocalizations are genetically inherited, part of the question is, how strongly is that genetically inherited, especially with territorial calls? Now, does son sound like father, like grandfather, like great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather? On the depot where the study was, we've been working there. We've been recording males. We've been recording the males' vocalizations. And they'll come in and like the playback. The first thing they do is they want to talk about it a little bit. Huh? And so they'll call. They'll give territorial calls. Well, I also have some high quality audio recorders that I place alongside the burrow so that I can record their voices. Huh? Okay. Well, they're all banded. So I know individually who they are and who their kids are, who their sons are. and who their grandsons are. And so now I have somewhere up between 6 and 7 generations of males in any particular, in several different particular lineages that I have their recordings. Okay. Last year, 2020, was a good reproduction year. We had 182 young last year, and the winter survival was pretty good. And so about 50% actually for the juveniles, which is quite high. Usually it's like 15%, but it was 50%. And we had brothers from last year coming back this year as breeding adults. Okay, so we have sets of 2 brothers or sets of 3 or sets of 4 brothers. So I made a special effort to record their voices because they had the same mother and father. So in fact, do they, the brothers sound the same? Aha. And so now we're starting to get into the juicy bits, huh? Since you know who they all are and you can record who they are, and then you can go into some detailed audio evaluations about how close do they sound or how different do they sound. So we're still investigating that now. I can tell you that some of the brothers sound very similar and some of them don't. I was surprised, but it was because that one of the brothers had swallowed something and it had wrecked his vocal cords. So he had a bad voice altogether. It didn't sound hardly like an owl even. So sometimes, you know, bad things happen to good owls, right? We'll find out now in the course of the next few months about the lineages of owls and how their relationship. Now, with other species of owls, we know that half of the vocalization can come from the father and the genetics, half from the mother, and they can sound like a mix. And so there is good reason for the males in a particular lineage to sound similar. If you were a female, there's 2 reasons. Either you'd want to be attracted to any other vocalizations that are not part of your own family. Okay, and you can recognize your own family. You recognize your brothers and your cousins and all of that. And so there may be good reason to stay far from them. Huh? So, but the whole point there is it helps avoid inbreeding, okay, if you're a female. Yeah, and it and helps for other males. And in that they become socially dominant through time. And maybe there are lineages that are more dominant than others or not. Okay, but we're just now at the tip of the iceberg in understanding some of these intrinsic things that the owl's been doing for millions of years, and we're just figuring it out now.
Yeah, you mentioned having recordings of the males. So are you recording any of the females, like the audio or the noises that they make, their vocalizations as well?
We've been targeting the males' territorial calls because that's the main call that we use among all owl species to help differentiate the species, okay? And so certainly there are females who make lots of sounds and there can be chatterboxes at time. And so the females are often the more dominant of the sexes. And so what they say kind of goes, right? But there, it's more difficult to get a specific call from each female. Huh? Okay, so that we can compare them. Are they sisters? You know, you can imagine some challenges like that, and it would be made more difficult if you cannot get a, like in the males, we can solicit a territorial call. So, but certainly we hear other calls, and they're very interesting, and they're very soft. Some of them, personal communications and among mated pairs is sweet.
Thank you. Yeah, I was just wondering about it. I was like, oh, I wonder why males specifically, but that makes sense. And I was wondering too, so you mentioned that the population of burrowing owls has been increasing and that there are more juveniles each year, which is really exciting. I was wondering too, so are these owls coming from elsewhere? Like, how is the population just increasing because of births, or is it that others are coming since now there's like habitat and burrows for them? They're like flying from somewhere else and finding that that's a good place to stay.
I know that's a complicated question. I think of it this way, that the regional populations, and in fact, much of the North American population is declining. Okay. It may be increasing on the depot because of the situation there. There isn't always good years or better years. It just happens to be. This past year, 2021, was a good nesting season because it was a mild winter last winter, and it was a fairly dry spring. And so that allowed the owls the vegetation was shorter, 2 to 6 inches rather than 12 to 14 inches, and it was less dense. And that allowed the males to have better access to the prey. Okay. If you can't get access to the prey, it doesn't do you much good, right? And so they had really good access this year. Well, as a response, boom, lots of kids, and they all did well. Right. So there's good years, and they've also had some terrible years. And so it goes back and forth, and it depends on the wintering locations of the males, the winter in Washington, as it turns out to be, the conditions for the females in the wintering range in California, where they go individually down there. And then the amount of rain that comes in the spring that can cause it to be cold and wet. And then the prey cycles themselves, the seed crop for small mammals and the grass for the grasshoppers and so forth. So it's quite complicated. But without nest burrows, it'd be game over. So that part's easy, right? So now you just buckle up and ride along.
Yeah, I was thinking about how complicated and interconnected everything is. Kind of a separate question that just popped in my mind. Are there any efforts to restore the badgers or to like kind of reintroduce badgers in the area? Because they were what were making the nests previously, right? Or they are making those burrows and then the owls would move in.
Yes, absolutely. So for much of the burrowing owl range, the burrowing owls utilize the burrows made by other fossorial animals. Okay. In Florida, it's there's a gopher tortoise. Okay. Armadillos. Yeah. In the Southwest, it's desert tortoises, kit foxes, and very significantly prairie dogs. Okay, throughout the Western U.S. and into Mexico. Right. There's another species called the viscacha. In Brazil, in Argentina, it's a small chinchilla-like animal that makes burrows now. And so on the depot in Northern Oregon and Washington, there never was prairie dogs. And so it's been badgers in large measure that have been the predominant maker of the burrows. And so now to your question about reintroduction, certainly we've had talks and discussions about reintroduced badgers, and that's the plan, because do you want to monitor and manage artificial burrows for 100 years? No, that makes no sense. Okay. Is there a good food base for badgers? Yes. They eat paca gophers in particular. You know, they're small mammals. And so there's lots of paca gophers. And in fact, I think the first badgers we reintroduce to the depot will eat like kings and queens because of the many, you know, paca gophers have had free reign. Huh? And in fact, the reintroduction of badgers there and the subsequent eating of paca gophers will actually be beneficial for the native plants, because that the roots of the native plants are what the paca gophers are eating. So it'll put things back in balance, and it'll put us out of artificial burrow business and get the owls back on track. Yes, badgers eat some owls, but that's how they've evolved, right? So a functioning system is better.
Yeah, a recent episode focused on kelp forests and sea otters, and we talked a lot about balance. So if there are any listeners who listen to that episode as well, they might capture some of those similarities. An aquatic ecosystem is different, but similar in that, you know, things have to be in balance. There have to be, there's some stability in different types of ecosystems. And is the stability, you know, allowing for diversity or not, right? You know, if there's an urchin barren, then there's a lot less diversity than a kelp forest, which has a lot more structure and a lot more diversity of what's living there, or who's living there. I guess, can we go back to the Global Owl Project? Now that we've kind of zoomed in really far to burrowing owls and Oregon, I'm interested in learning more about some of the other projects that you're doing. And just, I imagine it's just phenomenal to have that, you know, really wide lens on what's going on internationally with owls.
Yeah, it's all I can do to keep up. It's been great fun to work with these wonderful people, caring hearts around the world. So I have master's and PhD students and lots of colleagues, of course, in various capacities. One of the other projects we have going now is is based on a PhD student I have, Aleph Gosser, from Turkey. And she has put on little tiny backpacks on a gram and a half. They are on the backs of Scops owls. Scops owls are 85 gram owls. They are very nocturnal, insect-eating forest owls. Okay, they're found across Europe and parts of Asia. And we had understood, based on the bird observations, that Scops owls winter in sub-Saharan Africa, South Central Africa. Really? They go from Turkey and Spain and Slovenia and so forth to sub-Saharan Africa? Do they cross the Mediterranean? Is that how they get there? So we put on these little tiny GPS tags, and they record one fix per day. They're not transmitters because the batteries are too tiny. They only record one fix per day at high noon because I know they're nocturnal and I want to get them when they're sitting. Okay. And so we get 300 fixes and then the battery runs out. Okay. Well, I time them so there's one fix per day starting in September and going until late May or June when they should be back. And yes, in fact, they do go to sub-Saharan Africa. We found that birds from Turkey, central Turkey, will fly to the across the eastern end of the Mediterranean, down along through Israel and Jordan and so forth. And then one of them, the first one, the male, flew the length of the Red Sea, right down the middle. It took him 2 days. We named him Moses. And then continued on to Tanzania and spent the winter there. Other ones spent the winters in Ethiopia. These are accurate enough data recorders, GPS tags, that we could identify the individual trees that they were spending the winters in. Those from Spain flew down across Gibraltar and then down to Morocco and so forth, down to Senegal and for the winter, and Ghana, right? And the ones from Slovenia flew down to the boot on Italy, and then across the center of the Mediterranean, 2 days across it, landed in Libya, spent the next nine days flying across the Sahara Desert. They're tough little owls, and they end up spending the winter in Nigeria. And then came back. And we're so impressed. But that's the kind of breakthrough new science that we would like to be part of, because we can really learn something for conservation purposes. So now the question is, do the Scops owls fly along the same routes as other birds? Are there any stopover points along the way that would be of mutual benefit for protection? Well, just finding out new things about them, huh? And so there's projects like that, sometimes with technology, other times with not, just observations. So, yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah, that's so impressive to think about how far these little owls are flying, but also, too, just how dangerous it is. You know, any animals that move, was it transnationally or, you know, across multiple continents even, there's just so many conflicts, you know, human conflicts going on. I imagine that it could be dangerous to the owls. Are you noticing any, like, I guess how many owls, like little backpacks are you collecting again? I imagine some don't return or maybe die somewhere in the middle.
Sure. You know, if these tags are such that you have to recapture the birds in order to get the data. And so we've recaptured 17 in Turkey, which is about half of the tags, which is very impressive. And we actually got a couple of the tags that we did not catch the first year. The bird did not return to the study area, but just off of it, actually. And we caught the bird in the second year, it returned. And we were able to charge up the little GPS tag and got the data. And we can actually reuse these tags, recharge them and use them again. So we could even use them on other species, if we were so inclined. But I'm kind of stuck with the owls, and so I love that.
You're listening to an episode of Living Downstream on KQUA, brought to you by Umpqua Watersheds.
Yeah, it seems like if you have a passion, especially for a certain species, and you are an owl expert, if they are grateful for anyone, I feel like they would be grateful for you. Are there any other interesting things you've learned through your work? I know I watched a presentation you did on myths and culture around owls, and I think that would be really interesting. You can speak to that on here if you'd like, but also just in general to understand how people think about a species, like you mentioned, or any number of species, because that certainly does impact what we do about them, right? Whether we're going to put in the effort and the time and the money to protect them or not.
Right. The myth and culture, the focus there is there's lots of myths, right? And it's it's not hard to find junk mail about owls. Yeah. And some of it's cute and all that. And some of it's really sweet and some of it's beautiful. The artwork and so forth is fantastic. So does it matter? Does that matter in conservation? Okay. And if so, how? And so the idea with the Myth and Culture Project was try to peel back the myth part of it and get to the facts. And so we've looked at essentially all the literature, found 900 publications that describe in some detail about the human-owl relationship, okay? What do we really know? Are there owl parts, owls that are buried with people in archaeological context? Did paleo people use owls? Yes, they did. We've had some sites where there are 500 snowy owl wings. Not the chest, not the breast, not the heads, wings. Okay, or talons, very substantially talons. So owls were used in symbolism 15, 20,000 years ago. Okay. And so, well, certainly the relationship, the human-owl relationship goes back very deep in time. All right. And so how is it manifested? There's traditional medicine that's involved. In some places, owl eggs are used in gambling because of the power of the owl. Feathers are often used, like in Siberia, around baby cribs. The feathers are tied to help keep the baby safe. It's a protectorate. Yeah. In North Central Australia, their owl is the creator being. It actually started the earth. The Wardaman tribe of Aborigines took me to the place. I was the second white guy who had ever been there. What an honor. And they said, this is a place where the earth started. So there are some very strong beliefs about owls, positive and negative. And I think the worst case scenario we've found from a conservation perspective. But the thing with myth and culture is the idea is that we celebrate the human-owl relationship, whatever it is. Yeah, we're not passing judgment. We're just trying to understand what it is. And in some places, owls are very dangerous spirits. Yeah, the people there in some tribes and so forth, they're not even birds. These are shapeshifter spirits that take the shape of an owl when they want to. Yeah, and so they're dangerous. But other places, it's a mixed bag. Yeah, only a few places are owls viewed as just birds. Okay, now we're packaging up all of the information. We've done 6,000 interviews in 30 countries and so forth. And now we're packaging that all up with the literature and other aspects about the cultural beliefs. And we're also examining now, how do cultural changes happen? Okay. We used to kill people for being witches in Salem. Now we dress up on Halloween as witches. Huh? So our cultural views can change and did change. And so, we see that with owls too. Huh? And so we find four things that kind of influence change. First one is, and these are not in any particular order, laws. Okay, national and state laws change, and provincial laws change people's behavior. Owls are protected by law now, okay, in 1972. All right. We find that there are people who are change agents, leaders. We either elect leaders that, and or they have a propensity to rise to the top. And so we follow them. Third is education. We have K through 12, we have colleges, technical colleges and so forth. And so we can learn about biology and various species and so forth. And so, and the other thing that we found was grandmothers and this key role that grandmothers have. Often mothers are so busy raising the kids, it's grandmothers that pass on the cultural knowledge, cultural status of things. Yeah. And so those are the four kind of underlying things that affect cultural change. So, all right, we're digging deep with the owls in myth and culture to try to understand the factual aspects of the human-owl relationship and how do things change.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of great information. And I imagine that that would be similar with other species too, that, yeah, like grandmothers and laws and change makers in the community, change agents, yeah, have a lot of influence and certainly education. Have you witnessed any changes in terms of conservation or in terms of behavior, you know, based on your work?
Yes. From a bigger cultural perspective, okay, certainly there's been local influences and so forth, but at a national level, here's a couple of examples, okay? In Iran, all right, when we interviewed 350 people there about their knowledge and beliefs about owls, the people that were 60 and older basically said, owls are bad news. If they come to your house and call, it means that someone will get sick or die. And we had one gentleman who wrote in there that if the owl stays long enough, the house itself will turn to ruins. Well, it turns out that little owls in Iran are the most common owl that people see there, and they nest in abandoned buildings. And so that created that rationale. When we asked people that were 30 to 60 years old, their answer was, oh yeah, we know the restaurant. And it's like, what? Yeah, there's a restaurant chain called Boof, B-O-O-F, Boof, because it sounds like an eagle owl. Yeah, that's the call they make. It's an onomatopoeic sound, and Boof. And there is a restaurant chain. There's 14 of these restaurants located around Iran. And they have a little woodsy owl kind of cartoon character on the door. And so they serve pretty good food, I hear. Yeah. So if you really felt like owls are bad news and sickness and death, you wouldn't name a restaurant chain Boof, right? And so there is a cultural change, a cultural shift. And without any formal educational programs, without a lot of owl science per se, cultural shifts happen. Okay. We did interviews in Belize, okay, with the Mayan people specifically of Mayan descent. And the interviews basically came back. 85% of the people said owls are bad news. If they come to your house and call, it means someone will get sick or die. But they're also good news if you're a hunter or fisherman. You're supposed to pay attention because you're about to be lucky. So pay attention. And then I found a publication from 1882 written by a linguist who was describing the Mayan language. And he got to the word owl and he described it as such, an, you know, the language part. And then he said, it means that if an owl comes to your house and calls, it means someone will get sick or die. But it's also good luck for hunters and fishermen. And the notion there is that the myths and the beliefs about owls haven't changed one millimeter in 130, 140 years in Belize. And so, so sometimes it doesn't change, okay? But other times it changes. And we've had others that are showing changes in various degrees, yeah?
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. It's so interesting to hear about what's going on in different parts of the world, for sure. Yeah, I was thinking too, as we're starting to get towards the end of the interview, if there are people who are interested in learning either more about your work or the Global Owl Project, or, you know, just wherever they are and wanting to get involved, we have listeners who are in Oregon, but then also in other states and other parts of the world. So are there some resources you'd recommend, whether it's websites or books or different things that people could check out?
Sure. We've had the Global Owl Project website up for 15 years, and it was recently hacked into, and so we shut it down rather than try to patch it together, and we're starting over. We're putting a new website together. We've got the skeleton to it, but no content yet. But so it's Global Owl, okay? And so globalowl.org. Okay, another good resource, website resource is from Dean Lewis. He's in Australia, theowlpages.com. Dean is an IT guy. He has a tattoo of an owl, a barn owl that covers his entire back. And he used to be our webmaster. And so when I gave presentations, I would show his back and say, he said that it took 3 8-hour sessions to get his tattoo. I said, that's the kind of commitment we're looking for from all of our Global Owl Project people. But owlpages.com is a tremendous resource that I can suggest to people. Yeah. So beyond that, there are any number of other venues to help owls. In many parts of the U.S. and Canada, there is a fall saw-wet owl migration program, saw-wet.net. Is the program. They do wonderful work. They capture owls that are in migration in September and October. And sometimes there's a few of them are active in the springtime as well. But the fall saw-wet owls, saw-wet.net. There's always a need for literature, scientific literature. And so one of the things that we're trying to do is pull together all of the published literature ever on owls, the scientific literature. There's about 60,000 publications. And so I have sometimes, there are people that say, I can't travel all around. And now with COVID and so forth, I really can't travel, but I can do stuff from home, or I can go to the library when they're open and I can help you with that. And so that's another venue to help pull together information on their favorite species. If you don't have one, let's find one. Yeah. And so that's another option. There's wildlife rehabilitation facilities, places around the country and around the world. They always are looking for interested and passionate helpers to transport or care for the raptors, owls in particular, but birds and other mammals. There are research programs at universities. Some of them have owl programs that people can volunteer to be participants of. I have some interns that work with me. I try to find, basically give people 5 or 6 different options, okay? And then one that tickles their fancy. Okay, let's find something that we can do together, and it's for the mutual benefit. Everybody wins, and the owls too. There's a number of things that can be done like that.
Yeah, that's a plethora of wonderful resources. I was jotting them down, and I'll put them in the resource section on our website as well so that people can check those out. Yeah, I guess to wrap up today's interview, what's something interesting that you've learned or experienced during your time spent working with owls and also learning how people think about them and interact with them around the world?
Sure. There's a lot of stuff there. One of the things that I find so fascinating is when I talk to people, they can recall for me the very first owl they've ever seen. And they could be 30, 40, 50 years ago, and they'll recall it in detail about the conditions that they saw it in, and it made such an impression. And it's so heartening to me, and it tells me just the power of owls and how it can affect people and how magical they can be and how that sticks with people, you know. It's not like robins or some other birds, pigeons and so forth. The owls are different, and they are really noticeably so. And so, okay. But that really holds true all around the world. It's people are people, and it's amazing that this sort of thing can transpire and you find this passion that can be kindled in that kind of context. And so I've also had some people with the myth and culture that were older than me, and I was asking them about their beliefs about owls, and they basically weren't sure. You know, their grandmother had told them that owls are kind of bad, but they see them all the time, and they said, I don't really know. Can you tell me? You're the expert. And so, and you find out interesting context of beliefs and how people are not sure always, and just the fascination. I think that's one of the things that really, really has struck me, is that there is a genuine fascination about the power of owls. Those two words, I think, are particularly important here. That I've learned that I was interested in owls all along, and since I was 11 and all of that. But no, it's much stronger than you think. I mean, sharks and bears, tigers, there aren't many descriptors that you need to know what those are. Owls too.
I was trying to think back to the first time I saw an owl, and I don't remember necessarily, but it is always exciting to see them or to hear them. And I know a lot of different people, will post on Facebook or will mention like, oh, I heard this type of owl or that type of owl. And it's just very exciting. So I think there is definitely that cross-culturally, that interest or kind of fascination, like you said. I guess, are there any other either things you'd like to share or upcoming projects that you're excited about? You already talked about some of them, but any last thoughts you'd like to leave our audience with?
This is plenty of time in advance, but the next World Owl Conference, and we don't have them all that often, but we've had, I think, 6 now World Owl Conferences, and the next one is in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and it is in October 2022. Okay, again, October 2022, and it's what we find is when the owl people all get together, we feel like brothers and sisters. You know, it's a close-knit, fun family. There's yes, it's professional and scientific and so forth, but it's so casual, and it's a chance for everybody to get together, whether you're involved directly with owls or just want to brush up against some owl stuff. And so that's one of the things that I'd like to share. I think there continues to be a growing interest in the myth and culture aspects and advancing conservation. One of the things that we found is that if you can protect owls, you'll do a better job of protecting biodiversity than with many other strategies. You know, owls are top level predators, and they really need our help. And by protecting them, we do a significant advantage, a cost effective management strategy for conservation.
Yeah, that's helpful to know. And I will make a note of the World Owl Conference on our website as well. That's very exciting. Hopefully things will have died down some with COVID, or we'll have managed things enough at that point. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
My pleasure. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad you're doing such great work. It's really, really wonderful. Thank you.
And thank you.
We'll be right back after a few brief announcements. Do you love to read? Are you interested in meeting new people? Would you like to learn something new? If you answered yes to any or all of these questions, you should check out Turning Over a New Leaf, an environmentally themed book club, which meets every other month to discuss a book or topic. You can learn more on Umpqua Watershed's website or Facebook page, or by emailing our Director of Education and Outreach at ryan@umpquawatersheds.org.
Now we have Janice Reed, president of Umpqua Watersheds and retired wildlife biologist who studied the northern spotted owl for over 30 years right here in the Umpqua Valley. We just heard a great conservation success story from Janice's friend and colleague, David Johnson. While the burrowing owls were given a big boost from the efforts on David's project, we know that a long-term solution will need to be instituted.
That's right. I visited the project area on more than one occasion, and I'm encouraged by the plans to return the system on the depot to the natural order with a badger reintroduction. David's efforts are heroic and inspiring. His dedication is truly admirable, but I know David would love nothing more than to know that the burrowing owl can make it without his continual intervention. The cooperation of federal, state, county, and private individuals was and is very important to continue to give the burrowing owl a chance at recovery in that area.
So can you make any comparisons with David's work here in the Umpqua Valley?
Yeah, sure. Here in the Umpqua Valley, one of our own owls is not so fortunate to have the boost that David gave to the burrowing owl. A simple increase in the number of nest sites will not return the spotted owl to the historic numbers. And the invasion of the eastern cousin of the spotted owl to the Pacific Northwest, the barred owl, in combination with a continual decline in the preferred habitat of the spotted owl, has resulted in a precipitous decline of one of our own native owl species.
How dire is the situation?
Well, the latest research analysis indicates that the northern spotted owl is on the brink of extinction if we do not change the way our forests are managed and do something to control the numbers and distribution of the barred owl.
What is it about the barred owl that's causing the decline in the spotted owl populations?
The bigger and more aggressive barred owl has invaded and excluded the smaller and less aggressive spotted owl from its high quality nesting sites. Research in our area has shown that the spotted owl numbers are approximately 15% of what the population was 30 years ago. But more important than individuals are the pairs. Reproduction can only occur if we protect our pairs from habitat degradation and barred owl influence. That same research indicates that the number of pairs is at 8% of what it was 30 years ago, and the reproduction has plummeted to zero or near zero. So the future of the northern spotted owls, and indeed our forests as we know them, rests in our actions.
Whoa, yeah, that's a steep decline. What impact is the barred owl having on our forests overall?
Well, it's difficult to know now what impact the barred owl will have on the future health and long-term viability of our native forests. The barred owls are a generalist predator, and their population is exerting tremendous predatory pressure on our native older forests. They've been known to eat fauna in the forest that the spotted owl never or seldom ate. Things like snakes, snails, amphibians, crayfish, and fish are part of the barred owl diet that are not spotted owl prey items. Their smaller home ranges result in greater numbers of barred owls, more than the spotted owl could ever manage. And the system of older forests in our area was not designed and did not evolve with that kind of predatory pressure that the barred owl has exerted on it. So the spotted owl is just one species in the old forest ecosystem, and it's one of the most studied species in the world.
How has the research done on them helped with the conservation efforts?
Well, the habitat conservation plans that were developed for the spotted owl are pretty comprehensive, and the models that were developed are used worldwide. These were plans developed before the exponential increase in barred owl numbers, and that sort of derailed our conservation efforts and the potential success of those plans. The recent experimental removal of barred owls in some areas of the spotted owl range indicates that without the barred owls, the spotted owl would do much better and their populations would stabilize, as was predicted in these conservation plans.
Yeah, it's tough to think about lethally removing one species to favor another, especially one with those big brown eyes. How do you feel about the lethal removal of barred owls to benefit the spotted owl?
Well, in our world, it's not something we can easily accept, but the alternative of extinction of one of these owls is also difficult to accept. The barred owls will not be eliminated and will continue to persist, but just like the burrowing owl, we need to do something that can give the spotted owl a boost in the short term while we examine the impacts of this relatively new invader to our native forests and the ecosystem before it's too late. But if you think about it, favoring one species over another is exactly what humans have always done. You know, do you weed your garden, remove scotch broom, keep blackberries from growing in certain areas of your property, or even try and rid your house of rats, squirrels, bats, and bees?
Yeah, that's an interesting way to think about it. Are there other situations where predators are removed to favor or help another species?
Yeah, there's plenty of examples. You know, mammals are not native to Hawaii, and humans have brought them there, whether it was accidental or intentional. And they really have a tremendous feral cat problem. And it has really decimated the bird community. So wildlife officials continually work to control the feral cat population to give the native birds a fighting chance and to stave off extinction, because, you know, extinction is forever. And I, for one, think that we need to give the native population a fighting chance, even if it means intervening in the short term. We owe it to them to give them that boost.
Are there any ways that people could get involved to help spotted owls or protect their habitat locally?
Well, one of the ways that people can get involved is to monitor some of the projects that are going on in the forest, whether it be state lands, federal lands. Get involved in making comments on those proposals. Make sure their wishes are met, their ideas are considered, and you can write to your legislature, your representatives in Congress, expressing that you would like to continue to protect the native fauna and flora in the area.
And I guess my last question would just be, are there additional ways that people could get involved or current opportunities for people to get involved with Umpqua Watersheds, our environmental organization?
Sure. We have several committees that look at different things in the Umpqua Valley and somewhat regionally. We have a conservation committee which focuses on looking at these timber sales on federal land and state lands, monitoring the Oregon Forest Practices Act, which applies more to private lands, but also applies to state lands. And we have a restoration committee that looks at restoring habitat. And then there's the outreach committee, which is involved in conducting events and other community outreach activities, such as the Umpqua River cleanup. We do Brewfest, which we probably aren't going to do this year because of COVID. A lot of our outreach events are put on hold due to the virus, but we hope to have other things in the works as we come out of this. And there's the education committee, which conducts educational programs with local students and within the community.
Thank you. Yeah, there are so many ways for people to get involved. And I am excited to have stepped now into the Director of Education and Outreach role. So people will be hearing from me in different ways as I transition away from my AmeriCorps position. And a new AmeriCorps member will be conducting these interviews and leading the radio program Living Downstream. So if people who are listening, this will be one of my last couple of radio show episodes that I'm hosting. But you'll still hear from me in different ways. And thank you so much, Janice, for being on the show today.
No, thank you, Ryan. Thanks for everything you've done for Umpqua Watersheds over this last year. And good luck, and we'll stay in touch.